Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Sifton of Human Rights Watch, who examines an ongoing investigation into charges that U.S. Marines were responsible for the brutal murders of 15 Iraqi civilians in November. Jeff Foe, founder of the Economic Policy Institute, who examines how the North American Free Trade Agreement destabilized and weakened Mexico's economy, exacerbating cross-border immigration. And Ned Lamont, a progressive candidate challenging Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman for his party's nomination, who discusses his surprising showing at the state Democratic convention forcing an August 8th primary. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Nearly 15 years after the deadly attack on U.S. troops in Somalia, the Bush administration is funding secular warlords to counter the growing influence of Islamic militias. In recent weeks, 140 people were killed in fighting amongst warlords in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, which has not had an effective government since 1991. Now, the Bush White House is fearful the lawless African state will become a home base for Al-Qaeda, able to launch attacks from the Horn of Africa into the Middle East. The transitional Somali government, in exile in Kenya, has condemned U.S. support for the same warlords who battled American troops in the early 1990s. The new secular confederation, the Alliance for the Restoration of Peace and Counterterrorism, is well armed with rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, and anti-aircraft guns. But a growing number of African specialists call the anti-terror strategy short-sighted. As John Prendergast of the International Crisis Group noted, in the long run, the conditions which allow the terror cells to take hold go unaddressed. Ted Dagny, an analyst with the Congressional Research Service, says the U.S. has done little to bring peace or stability to Somalia over the last decade. He observed, "We have a generation of Somali kids growing up without education, knowing only violence and poverty. Unless there is a change, these could become the next warlords out of necessity of survival." With the politics of Latin America moving to the left, the Sandinista movement in Nicaragua is undergoing an identity crisis. Daniel Ortega, the Sandinista president during the 1980s and the target of President Reagan's Contra war, is making another run for president. Recent public opinion polls place Ortega slightly ahead of his rivals for the November 5th election. Inside the Sandinista party, Ortega faces a challenge from outgoing Managua mayor Erty Loites, seen as a pragmatist who has won respect for fighting corruption. In an interview with the American Prospect magazine, Loites called for a new Sandinista platform, a center-left program that seeks a stable relationship with the United States. Meanwhile, Nicaragua remains the second poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, with nearly half its people surviving on less than $2 a day, and many families relying on funds sent by relatives who have immigrated to the U.S. or Costa Rica. Among many Nicaraguans, there is a growing call for new political leadership and disgust with Ortega and long-time Liberal Party boss Arnaldo Alemán, who was convicted of fraud and embezzlement. In an echo of American intervention in the country over the last 100 years, U.S. Ambassador Paul Trivelli met with Nicaragua's right-wing parties in April and unsuccessfully urged them to pick a single candidate to oppose Ortega. With the price of gasoline hovering over $3 a gallon, the prospect of raising car fuel economy standards is getting its most serious debate in a generation. Everyone from President George Bush to environmental groups are talking about raising fuel efficiency standards known as CAFE, but the formulas for change are radically different. New York Congressman Sherwood Bullard, a moderate Republican, says there is growing support in the House of Representatives for raising CAFE standards amongst incumbent GOP legislators facing tough challenges from Democrats. Bullard's bill would raise average fuel economy standards to 33 miles a gallon over the next decade. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, the Bush White House wants the authority to rewrite CAFE standards, but not necessarily to increase overall fuel efficiency. They want to break up the car fleet into size classes with weaker standards for larger vehicles. Recently, a new bipartisan bill has emerged in Congress called the Enhanced Security Act of 2006 to cut overall oil consumption by 2.5 million barrels a day over the next decade without explaining how it would be done. As Ashok Gupta of the National Resources Defense Council observed, like it or not, Detroit still has tremendous say in Washington, noting that Hillary Clinton and John Kerry voted against raising fuel economy standards the last time it came up in the Senate. They did not want to offend the car makers and the United Auto Workers Union. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Since the March 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, the civilian death toll resulting from the conflict remains a topic rarely discussed by American politicians or corporate media. While the Pentagon has refused to provide an estimate of Iraqi casualties, other groups have used various methods to arrive at the numbers of Iraqis killed. Iraq Body Count states that up to 42,000 have lost their lives, while The Lancet, a respected British medical journal, reported that a study in 2004 found that over 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died due to the U.S. invasion. The May 17th pronouncement of Representative John Murtha, Democrat of Pennsylvania, that U.S. Marines deliberately killed 15 unarmed Iraqi civilians in cold blood last November has momentarily refocused public attention on the little-discussed cost of the occupation. Murtha, an opponent of the war, said that a Pentagon investigation into a November 19th incident in the western Iraqi town of Haditha found that Marines had killed 15 or more Iraqi civilians execution-style in their homes after one of their comrades was killed by a roadside bomb. Among the dead were four women and five children, including a three-year-old girl. The Pentagon says the probe is not yet complete and refused comment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Sifton, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, who takes a critical look at the Pentagon's credibility in investigating soldiers accused of brutalizing civilians. Sifton also comments on the UN Committee Against Torture's call for the closing of the U.S. Navy's detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Well, we'd already been following this case for some time. Time magazine was actually the magazine that managed to break the story open in March of this year. They went to Haditha, they interviewed hospital staff, they interviewed some of the survivors and the relatives of the dead, and put it back together. Basically, the Marines lied about the incident. Somebody lied. It's not clear at what level the lie took place, but somebody lied about the incident, because when it was originally reported, the story was something entirely different. It was a story about civilians getting killed by an IED, an improvised explosive device, when in fact all of the dead had been killed by gunshot. And it later came to be known that they were killed by the Marines.
The initial information, which turned out to be wrong, was issued by the Pentagon itself, was it not?
It's possible that the Pentagon Public Affairs Office itself was misled by Marines down the chain. On the other hand, it's possible that they were part of the conspiracy to mislead journalists and they themselves knew the truth. It's too early to tell.
Do you feel that the U.S. military has acted responsibly in investigating this incident, and I'm sure dozens and dozens of other incidents that we hear about from time to time about civilians in the theater of war in Iraq being killed due to negligence or purposefully?
Well, there's a lot of variations. Sometimes the investigations are good, but sometimes they're done pretty badly, and there's been a lot of examples of the Army Criminal Investigative Command sweeping cases under the rug. The Navy Criminal Investigative Service, which is responsible for this investigation, has a better record, but it remains to be seen whether this investigation will be thorough and complete. We're a little disappointed already at how slow it's going. These cases often take much longer than they should, and we'd like to see them move a little quicker.
What could be done from the point of view of your organization, Human Rights Watch? What should be done within the military, within the Pentagon, to limit these kinds of incidents? And you always hear the cry that war crimes and and murder of civilians are an inevitable byproduct of war anywhere. But what could be done to limit it?
Well, they may be inevitable, but there's some control over whether you can lower the amount of atrocities which take place, because certainly a better criminal justice system in the military will yield a lower amount of atrocities. The question is whether the U.S. military has a sort of consistent, strong accountability mechanism, and the truth is it just doesn't. The U.S. military justice system is very good for punishing people for disciplinary infractions and things like that, but it's terrible at dealing with widespread abuse or scandal. And that's because it's not independent. Unlike district attorney's office and U.S. attorney's office at the federal level, military prosecutors really have no discretion. They make recommendations to commanding officers, and commanding officers decide whether people are going to be charged or not. It's just not a recipe for consistent accountability. It's not a good recipe for preventing atrocities when troops feel like if they play their cards right, they can slip out from under the yoke of punishment. And that's why you don't see consistency in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, I wanted to turn to a different subject here in the same general area, John Sifton, and that is an 11-page report was issued by the United Nations Commission Against Torture, a panel of 10 independent experts on adherence to the UN Convention Against Torture, of which the United States is a signatory. And they have called on the United States, on the Bush administration, for a closure of the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, naval base. Tell us a little bit about this.
The truth is the Bush administration has tried to sell a bunch of really bogus legal theories to the committee and to the world at large. One of them is that they're allowed to hold people indefinitely and incommunicado, away from the Red Cross. Nobody can see them. You know, forget the people at Guantanamo for a second. Most of the main high-level terrorist suspects who were involved in September 11th, who have been captured, are not held at Guantanamo, and they're not in Afghanistan, and they're not in Baghdad. They're at secret sites somewhere in the world. Nobody really knows where most of the time. If you go on the White House website, they boast about them being held. So they went to Geneva and they tried to, you know, justify that, and the committee just threw them out on their ear, saying that's just legally unjustifiable. They also talked about Guantanamo, saying, you know, Guantanamo, the Red Cross is there and lawyers can go. It's not a tenable situation. There's been a lot of reports of abuse. The people there have no way of challenging their detention if they're innocent. It's another problem. So that was another issue that they criticized them for.
That was John Sifton, terrorism and counterterrorism researcher with Human Rights Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. Immigration has emerged as one of the most contentious issues in U.S. politics this year. A punitive bill has passed the House of Representatives, which would criminalize undocumented workers and citizens who help them, and fund construction of a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The threat of arrest and deportation prompted millions of people to march for immigration rights in cities around the country, demanding a path to citizenship for the nation's estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants. The Senate continues to debate legislation that differs substantially from the House bill. A proposed measure would expel undocumented immigrants who have been in the U.S. less than 2 years, create a guest worker program for those here between 2 and 5 years, and provide a path to citizenship for those who have been in the country more than 5 years. But in the debate on Capitol Hill and in the media, one issue is just about never raised, except by the immigrants themselves. That is the U.S. role in creating an economic crisis in Mexico, where 75% of the undocumented immigrants in the U.S. come from. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jeff Foe, founder of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and now a distinguished fellow there. He explains how the North American Free Trade Agreement destabilized and weakened Mexico's economy, exacerbating cross-border immigration, and why more than fences are needed to address the problem.
Before the North American Free Trade Agreement, illegal immigration from Mexico was less than half of what it is now. And if you go back 20 years, before the early 1980s, it was just a trickle. Mexico at that time was poor, but their economy was relatively stable. What happened was, as a result of the U.S. helping bailing out Mexico in the early 1980s, they had a crisis with their currency at that time, Mexico started to deregulate, to privatize, and its growth in the 1980s slowed down. And you saw illegal immigration begin to accelerate. And then with the North American Free Trade Agreement, illegal immigration really took off from Mexico. Why? A number of reasons, but the most important is that the treaty forced Mexico to open up its borders to subsidized and cheap U.S. corn and wheat from Canada as well. This meant that from 1 to 2 million Mexican farmers could no longer live on their land. They could not compete with the subsidized big agribusiness corn that was coming in from the United States. So they were driven off their land with their families and with the workers that that worked for them. These were small farmers. There were no jobs in the cities, and so they came to the United States, risking their lives. More than 400 died last year crossing the border. So you've got to look at two sides to an immigration problem. That is, the side to which the immigrants are going and the side from which they're coming. And we're not looking at that second at all.
Jeff Foe, if we do look at it, what do you think could help solve the problem?
Well, the essential problem here is that we made a treaty with Mexico, a so-called free trade agreement, that did not take into consideration what would happen to the people. So it was an agreement that allowed trade and money to flow across the border, but did not provide for the social protections that every economy has for its people. Didn't provide for minimum wages, didn't provide for free and open union elections, it didn't provide for unemployment compensation, things of that sort. And it didn't provide for a program for Mexico that would stimulate economic growth in a way that provided jobs and raised incomes for Mexicans. During the debate over NAFTA, we were promised by both Republicans and Democrats, by the way, that Mexico would grow and illegal immigration would diminish. Instead, illegal immigration took off in Mexico. If you compare the free trade agreement that we made with Mexico with the way that the European Union organized the economic integration of Western Europe back in the 50s and 60s, you can see what I'm talking about. In Europe, when they first began this idea of integrating the markets, people in France and Germany and Holland and the richer countries were frightened at the notion that people from Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland would flood their economies with workers looking for work. So they provided, in addition to the trade and money that crossed the border, they provided help for those countries, and they required, as a condition of being in the economic, in the European Union, labor laws and laws that, you know, allowed the kind of growth that got in Portugal and Spain and places like that, allowed that growth to be shared broadly in the population. It created jobs that had decent incomes, and lo and behold, people did not move. People did not migrate from those countries. So it's an extraordinary lesson that if people have job opportunities, not job opportunities equal to the United States, but at least opportunities for people to get a job, have a decent wage, be able to support a family, people would rather stay where they are. And we hear that in the interviews with migrants. But we did not take that into consideration. What essentially we did was make a treaty with Mexico that provided benefits for the rich on both sides of the border, and the poor, especially Mexican poor workers, were the people who paid the price.
That was Jeff Foe of the Economic Policy Institute, Call EPI at area code 202-775-8810 or visit the group's website at www.epinet.org. Foe's book, Global Class War, has recently been published by John Wiley & Sons. On March 13th, Ned Lamont, a relatively unknown communications entrepreneur, announced his candidacy to challenge Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman. Since then, the progressive Democrat has crisscrossed the state, working to win 15% of the delegate votes needed at the Democratic Party nominating convention on May 19th to force a primary against Lieberman. To the surprise of many, including his own campaign staff, Lamont won more than 33% of the vote among the party establishment at the convention and will now go head-to-head with Lieberman in an August 8th primary. One of the major issues that has polarized Connecticut Democrats on Lieberman is the three-term senator's strong support for President Bush's invasion of Iraq and his alliance with the White House agenda on a host of economic and social policies. This unexpected race between a political newcomer and Lieberman, the party's 2000 vice presidential candidate, has been the focus of growing interest across the U.S. The Progressive Political Action Committee, MoveOn.org, is conducting a poll of its 50,000 Connecticut members to determine if the grassroots group will help Lamont in the primary. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ned Lamont about his successful drive to force a primary and the reasons he's challenging Joe Lieberman, often referred to as President Bush's favorite Democrat.
It seemed like sort of an inside baseball game to me, most of the party establishment, so we didn't quite know how people were going to come out. So we got over a third of the delegates to stick their neck out. It took a certain amount of courage for them to cast their vote for the Lamont campaign. So thanks, guys.
Ned Lamont, a lot of the press reports about your showing at the convention talk about your challenge to Lieberman as being solely around the Iraq war and Lieberman's support of President Bush on that policy. Is there more going on here than just opposition to the war?
Yeah, I think we should challenge the Bush administration policies across the board. I really believe that the country's adrift right now away from its center. And I think I'm the senator who's going to do that. You know, I would challenge him on the Terry Schiavo case, where we have a federal government that's beginning to intrude into our private lives in ways we've never expected. I would stand up for Social Security and Medicare. This is a basic deal that we've had between the federal government and our seniors for a long time. I think it's being challenged now, and I think they're trying to undercut the safety net in our country. I think on the environment and I think on energy, I believe that the energy bill was a bad bill written by lobbyists. I would have opposed that, like Chris Dodd opposed that, and put much more of an emphasis upon conservation. I think that's the best way to free ourselves from Middle Eastern oil and at the same time deal with the environment in a real way.
As far as the national repercussions of your race against Senator Lieberman, after all, he's a stalwart Democrat for many years, ran for vice president, and by many accounts won the vice presidency with Al Gore in 2000. What's the national message in your view of the discontent that many Democrats have with Joe Lieberman and with many of the leadership in the Democratic Party?
I salute Senator Lieberman's long service to our state and to our nation, but I do believe that all that stability goes not if you're not on the right side of the big issues of the day. And I think that now is the time that we need a senator who stands up. We've got to fight for good-paying middle-class jobs with health care and decent benefits. There's a sense that our middle class in the state and this country is under siege, and I'll be the senator to take that fight. To the degree to which I talk to people nationally, I think I'm saying I think Democrats start winning and America starts winning when we're clear and bold about where we stand. And we're going to show on August 8th that Democrats have a constructive agenda for taking the country in a new direction. We're not going to be talking about finding common ground with the Republicans, but we're going to be talking about the common good and how we can get our government fighting on behalf of working people. And I think when people see that on August 8th, that's going to send a message 90 days before the general election that that's how we win.
And Ned, what's your position on the Iraq war? Immediate withdrawal, gradual withdrawal, some some timeline for getting the U.S. troops out of there. What's your view on that?
I believe right now we have 132,000 brave soldiers stuck in the middle of a civil war. And at this point, it's high time for the Iraqis to take control of their own destiny. It's going to be a political solution. There's no way that we can impose it at the barrel of a gun. So I believe that it's time for us to start taking our troops, get them out of harm's way, start bringing them home. Yes, we'll be there to provide some political support as the Sunnis and the Shias try and work this through. We'll be there for reconstruction and humanitarian support. But I think our days as taking the lead role in a military sense should be over.
And just a question on health care. There's been a lot of efforts over the years, unsuccessful efforts, to put the country in some kind of track to get universal health care for the poorest, the 40-plus million that don't have any health insurance. How do you think the Senate should tackle this issue?
I think there's probably no more important issue right now than health care. I think it's a system that's broken. We have not only do we have 47 million people who are uninsured, the number of uninsured and underinsured is growing. It's a burden upon our employers. And I just believe that we've got to put that front and center on our agenda. You know, what I would do is try and work towards a universal coverage, and we can do that a number of ways. One way is to have, here's a basic minimum package that all employers are obligated to provide. And from there, we're going to find some ways that the federal government can help subsidize and reduce the cost. And I think that way we're going to get towards A, universal coverage, and B, allow our employers to better compete around the world.
Just something else that the Lieberman supporters bring up that I think is, you know, important to respond to, and that is this. They say that a primary fight will divert money and energy away from more important Connecticut races, such as the campaigns to unseat Chris Shays in the 4th District, Nancy Johnson in the 5th District, and Rob Simmons in the 2nd District. How do you view that charge as somehow your primary challenge to Lieberman is being destructive?
I think we're getting Democrats out who haven't voted in a long time. We're showing that there's a real difference between Republicans and Democrats on issues that count. And I think for that reason, we're going to have three new Democratic congressmen because we're giving people a reason to vote and a reason to vote Democrat. You know, you mentioned Chris Shays. Sure, he's already endorsed Joe Lieberman. That makes Diane Farrell's contest a little more complicated. They're not going to have that issue with Ned Lamont setting the ticket.
That was Ned Lamont, Democratic candidate challenging Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman. Contact the Lamont campaign by calling area code 203-622-7091 or visit their website at www.nedlamont.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.